staying alive in Puerto Rico today on The World. After the hurricane, Alberto and Mireya were at their wits' end. Mireya had a stroke, the power was out, and Alberto had to improvise with solar and wind power just to keep her alive.
He's been his companion for 45 years. They have two sons, they have grandkids together. That it was his turn to be a really good partner to her.
Also today, Brexit. The British government wants the best possible divorce deal, but EU negotiators are playing hardball.
You're leaving, you're a third country, you're going to be like Canada, the United States, or others, so you can have a trade deal down the road, but right now, we need you to leave.
That and much more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you along today. I woke up to a faulty smoke alarm early this morning. We've got a circuit breaker in the basement, and in theory, throwing the switch for the smoke alarm should turn them off. My problems, though, I realized when I came to work, are nothing compared to what I saw in an online video to prepare meeting our first guest on the show today. Imagine a different circuit breaker. There's a wire going into it, and it's dedicated not to smoke alarms or a fridge. It's dedicated to a person, to keeping that person alive. That's the story behind Alberto and Mireya. They're the subjects in one of a series of short documentaries. Andrea Patiño Contreras produced them for Univision about some of the Puerto Ricans who survived Hurricane Maria. A year ago today, they were braving wind, floods, and landslides. Alberto and Mireya lived in Yabucoa, an area hit hard by Maria. And then Mireya got sick. Here's Andrea Patiño Contreras.
Mireya had a stroke a month after Maria made landfall. She had already had two strokes in the 8 years before that. So this was her third and the worst. She was in pretty bad shape. She actually had four small heart attacks during that time. The last one, it took doctors 9 minutes to revive her. So by the time all of that happened, you know, they were pretty certain she wasn't going to live for much longer.
Cuando yo me la traje del hospital, ellos me la dieron bajo el programa de hospicio, que es un programa para pacientes terminales.
Right here, Alberto's describing what happened in the hospital. The doctors basically told him, okay, you can take her now home under this hospice program, but for that, we need you to have electricity 24/7 so that she can use all the machines she's depending on and to have AC so that she's comfortable, right? But they didn't have electricity, so that was a challenge for him. So he had to come up with this system to keep her alive.
I mean, it's such a reminder of how much we take electricity in this country for granted. What was Alberto's plan?
Okay, so he had a generator, but that was not enough. He couldn't run that 24/7 because it's very loud, it's very expensive, it's not feasible. So he basically came up with this system. He knew a little bit about wind power and solar energy. So he decided to utilize that. He created a whole kind of small electrical grid that basically feeds Mireya's machines. With his family, he started innovating and putting all these pieces together. It was very hard to find, for instance, batteries. He mentioned he would have to drive to San Juan one day, and then the next day his son would go try to find another battery. So slowly they were able to put together 8 batteries and then create this whole system for Mireya's machines exclusively. And right now they don't depend on the electrical system at all because they know the electrical grid is very, very fragile. If there's another storm, even if it's not a hurricane, it could put it down. That's why they want to keep this innovative system in place.
So a kind of silver lining to the story, Alberto's kind of independent from the grid. How about Mireya? How's she doing now?
She's doing well within the limitations that she has right now. As I mentioned before, she was expected to only live for a couple of weeks after she was released.
Yeah, so this is kind of miraculous.
Exactly. It's been almost a year in November, and he says that she has improved a little bit. I mean, she's never going to go back to the way she was. He talked about, when we interviewed him, the immense love he feels for her. She's been his companion for 45 years. They have two sons. They have grandkids together. That it was his turn to be a really good partner to her. And of course, it's not easy. It has really changed their lives, their routines, and he's, you know, her main caretaker. She's in bed 24 hours a day, and he's with her most of the time. So it has really changed his family.
You know, it's a 3-minute documentary, and I was tearing up. I mean, it really ought to become an art house film. So powerful. But so is the person in this other video you produced. It's also very moving.
Cuando llueve, siento pánico. Le tengo terror a la lluvia. El corazón se me acelera.
So this woman, her name is Nieves. Tell us what she's saying there.
So in this clip, Nieves is describing the feelings she experiences when it rains. She feels panic, she's terrified, she wants to run away, and her heart starts racing. And these are feelings that came after living through Hurricane Maria.
What did she actually kind of experience during the hurricane?
During the hurricane, she was in her home with her mother and her baby daughter, and her house flooded very badly. When she started seeing the water coming through the doors, she basically panicked, and she describes this feeling of being completely frozen and not being able to move at all. She describes that she was hearing her neighbors kind of knocking on her door, knocking through the windows, and at some point it kind of clicked, and she opened the door. One of the neighbors came in running and picked up the baby daughter, and luckily they were able to get out safely. She lost most of her things. When we saw her a couple of months ago, she still didn't have a bed, she didn't have a lot of basic things, but she felt very grateful that she had been able to get out alive with her mother, because in that town in particular, a few people drowned.
Right. Well, as you explained, 4 feet of floodwater went through her house. So it makes sense that a life-changing event like Maria could be traumatic and is still traumatic. Do we know how many Puerto Ricans were diagnosed or reported that the hurricane affected their mental health?
So those numbers are actually very difficult to get. There's a Puerto Rican entity that deals with mental health and addiction crises called AMSCA. And we met with the director, Suzanne Roig. They have acknowledged that there was an increase in suicide deaths by about 18-20%, more or less. But other conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, they're very hesitant to speak about those numbers, actually, and make the correlation between the suicides and a direct relation to Maria. However, we did speak to a number of psychiatrists and doctors who, based on their experiences and anecdotal evidence, they knew that anxiety and stress and depression were on the rise. But the exact numbers were very, very difficult to come across. Some of the hospitals we visited, they were saying, you know, some of our patients need to wait for weeks or for months to get an appointment. It's certainly a challenge, and I think we're probably going to see more of these conditions coming up in the next few months.
Well, Nieves is still traumatized by Hurricane Maria. Here's Nieves again.
Yo llegué a sentir mucha frustración y llegué a sentir deseos de quitarme la vida, pero no soy capaz de hacerlo.
In this clip, she's describing that she's felt very frustrated and that, in fact, she has thought about committing suicide a couple of times, but then she would immediately think of her baby and that she doesn't want to leave her alone, and that would kind of keep her going.
Yeah, you can really hear how it's very complex for her, just in her voice, even if you don't understand Spanish. So these were just 2 stories from a series you did of these mini-docs. What struck you most about your reporting in Puerto Rico and the people you met who are coping?
I think a few things. One of the most powerful things we saw with my colleague Patricia when we were reporting, I think, was that people were extremely not only resilient, but resourceful as well. Like, I think Alberto is, you know, a great example of that, right? Mm. People, when they face the circumstances, they were very quick to come up with solutions. We noticed a lot of community-based solutions, a lot of localized responses. You know, that's partly because the central government was not able to respond in time and properly. But people were very, very community-oriented. I think Puerto Ricans are proud of that, and you could tell that people had helped each other tremendously through this difficult time.
Andrea Patiño Contreras is a reporter with Univision. You can watch her short documentaries about how individual Puerto Ricans coped with Hurricane Maria on the World's Facebook page. Andrea, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco, for having me.
Our partners at The Takeaway at WNYC in New York have been in San Juan all week reporting on Hurricane Maria 1 year on. Check out their podcast. And at theworld.org, you should check out my interview from yesterday with The Takeaway's Tanzina Vega, talking about what she's seen and where things stand with some Puerto Ricans' dreams of statehood. Again, you can hear that at theworld, one word, theworld.org. Another story we've been reporting on is a situation in Xinjiang in western China. There's a massive crackdown taking place there. The Chinese government is targeting the Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities. As many as 1 million people are detained there, held in so-called re-education camps.
How many of your friends and family are in the re-education camps? My father, my mother, my elder brother, younger brother, three younger sisters. From my wife's family, my brother-in-law, my mother-in-law, elder sister, younger brother. So from my immediate family, there are more than 20 people in the camps.
That's a man who was released from one of the camps and managed to get out of China. He was speaking with the BBC. Beijing denies there's a crackdown, and it's gone to great lengths to keep outsiders from observing what's going on. But a few researchers have managed to gather information from Xinjiang. Tim Gross is one of those researchers. He's an assistant professor of Chinese studies at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Indiana. So what kind of evidence are we talking about, Tim?
We have visual evidence. Of course, we have individuals who have looked through satellite images and have seen the kind of expansion and proliferation of these large, what appear to be detention centers. Some of the kind of identifying elements include barbed wire. We also have a form of visual evidence that's hard to dispute or deny, and that's actually photographs that were hosted by local government websites that have signage that quite literally reads concentration re-education centers. And then finally, but no way anywhere less important, we have now testimonies from not just family members of those who have been detained, but also survivors of these programs. So I think at this point, we maybe shouldn't discuss it or to talk about the growing amount of evidence as such, but rather as this indisputable proof of these mass detention centers.
So just a point of semantics here before we go on, what should we be calling these detention centers anyway?
Yeah, there's still a debate among Uyghur and specialists of the areas of what we should call them. And actually, the Chinese government itself isn't uniform in what these centers are called, depending on locale. For my own use, and the phrases that I've been encouraging others to use are either internment camps, or I think more preferably would be concentration re-education centers. And this takes some of the signage that we see in the visual evidence of these programs or of these centers and translates it verbatim.
So just on the satellite images, how much can you actually tell from them about what's happening on the ground?
From these satellite images, we have that visual evidence that detention centers or something that resembles detention centers exist. Other than that, it's hard to tell what's going on. We have a lot of corroborating reports that there is some uniformity among the daily routines of these detention centers, including a daily routine that includes these political education classes, marching in place, singing patriotic cadences, listening to video lectures about what's illegal and what's legal religious practice. And these days tend to be very, very scripted.
Tim, how did you get involved in this campaign?
Unfortunately, my engagement and participation and my outspokenness is very personal. I've had several friends and colleagues who have been victims of this of these mass incarcerations. And unfortunately, the vast majority of these individuals still remained in captivity today. And it's through family members that I know about their situation.
So the Chinese government denies this detention, re-education is even happening, so they're not going to allow access to camps that they say don't exist. How can Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities be helped?
As the world becomes more aware of it and there's mounting pressure from journalists and academics and government agencies and hopefully academic institutions, that eventually the pressure will be so great that the Chinese Communist Party eventually shifts its course, because quite frankly, there's very little room for them to deny these claims. The evidence, or again, the proof, is quite overwhelming.
Tim Gross telling us about how he's tracking the secret detentions of Uyghur Muslims in Western China. Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on the show, planting trees from Bethlehem to Lebanon. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Lebanon, Missouri, that is. That's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. The righteous flourish like the palm tree and grow like the cedar in Lebanon. That's from Psalm 92:12. I don't usually quote the Bible at the top of a story, but it's true. Lebanon has been known for its cedar trees since biblical times. We're thinking about that today because our friend Fadi Bukharam is on another road trip across the U.S. He's Lebanese, and we spoke with him a couple of years ago during his first cross-country trip. His mission? Visiting all 47 cities and towns in the U.S. named Lebanon. This time, Fadi is upping the ante. He's planting Lebanon cedars throughout America's Lebanons. So which Lebanon are you visiting next, Fadi?
The next Lebanon I'm visiting is Lebanon, Nebraska.
And yesterday you were in Lebanon, Missouri. You met the mayor. What else happened?
Not only did I meet the mayor, but he also read a proclamation and gave it to me announcing 20th September 2018 as a day of friendship between Lebanon and the city of Lebanon, Missouri, and aiming to renew these bonds of friendship.
That is so cool. So the last time you were in Lebanon, Missouri, what was the state of the cedar trees there?
I didn't find any. The purpose of this trip was trying to find cedar trees that were planted in 1955, but I couldn't find it. So,
remind us what happened in 1955.
It was the anniversary of the first centennial of the Lebanese immigration to the United States. The president then invited mayors of towns called Lebanon from the U.S. to Beirut. They were each given a cedar sapling that they took back. Unfortunately, only one of the seven trees survived.
Yeah, so what are you actually trying to accomplish on this trip? What's your mission?
Since I didn't find most of the trees, I wanted to get them new ones to renew that connection that we had.
So you're bringing these cedars around. Did you come with like 47 cedar trees from Lebanon?
I'm not planting 47 cedars. That'd be kind of impossible. This time I'm planting trees in about 12 to 14 of these towns. I didn't bring the saplings with me.
Yeah, so these are North American cedars?
Oh, no. There are cedars of Lebanon, but I got them from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and planting them in these towns.
Lebanon cedars from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. There's something going on there.
Right.
So you're visiting many of these places for the second time, Fadi. Do people remember you from the last trip?
For the most part, we never really cut ties. It was just a happy reunion.
The other thing to mention about that trip, it was right around the presidential elections. And I recall you were talking politics with a lot of people and greeted warmly pretty much wherever you went. Has anything changed?
The warmth is still there, but the political talk, they don't exist as much this time around.
So I have to mention this New York Times article that came out about a month ago. The headline read, "Climate change is killing the cedars of Lebanon." As you are planting these exact same trees across the U.S., how are you responding to this news?
It's sad news. Some of these trees are dying, but there's also other reservations in Lebanon where they're planting cedar trees. So I think there's a glass half full to look at these.
So what are your takeaways at this point, about halfway through your trip now? What have you learned?
If I've learned anything from all of this, is that people get along much better when there is this one-on-one human connection.
Dude, you could be up for an ambassadorship. Do you know that? Like, you would be the first Lebanese ambassador rolling around in a camper van.
I mean, we already have an ambassador, and he's doing an amazing job. I wouldn't mind doing cultural attaché kind of work.
Fadi Bukaram, great to speak with you again, and good luck on the rest of your trip.
Thank you so much, Marco, for having me.
Here's a story now from Kyrgyzstan, a place we don't hear a lot from. It's about a young singer-songwriter who's been getting death threats over a music video she made and released online. The death threats are not a reaction to what she's singing in the video. They're about what she's wearing. Here's the world's Carol Hills.
This is what Zira Asiobek sounds like. The 19-year-old singer is wearing in that video. Bright red lipstick, a short skirt, and a dark-colored blazer with nothing underneath but a very visible purple lacy bra. Via Skype, I asked her what she was trying to convey.
Well, I wanted to say that everyone is free to be the way they want and to dress up the way they want, and people shouldn't judge them by their appearance, and people should respect each other's choices. That's what I wanted to say in general.
Okay, but I think people in Kyrgyzstan are paying more attention to the purple lacy bra than her lyrics. Burmet Talant is a Kyrgyz journalist. She lives and works in Ukraine, but she's been following the social media response to Zira Asiobek's video.
Death threats came from men who demanded her to apologize for Kyrgyz nation because they thought that she shamed and humiliated the nation. And they thought that, oh, Kyrgyz girl cannot show her body to the entire world. and they took it personally.
Talent says what's interesting is that the song, called Kuz, or Girl, was released a few months before the video, and it got very positive responses on social media, especially from Kyrgyz women who supported its message of freedom and self-expression. It's only when the video came out that Asyabek started getting threats from men. One even threatened to behead her. She says some Kyrgyz women were also uncomfortable with the amount of skin she was showing. But Asyabek sees no need to apologize. In fact, she wanted the video to be provocative.
I am trying to get people into a huge conversation, and I knew that I had to do something triggering and provocative.
It's worked. It went viral immediately in Kyrgyzstan. Zira Asyabek is young. She's only 19, but she's been chafing against social conventions in her country for some time. I asked her what most 19-year-old Kyrgyz women think about. She didn't hesitate.
Most of the girls who are 19 in Kyrgyzstan, unfortunately, think a lot about being liked by the men, because like there are a lot of standards, like beauty standards, for girls here in Kyrgyzstan. So there are some stereotypes that girls should be not talkative, not expressive of their thoughts. The main purpose for girls is like to get married and have kids.
Her plans are different. She wants to continue singing and recording, and she also wants to become an actress. She says she'll have to go overseas to get her training, but she wants people to know that she loves her country and plans to come back. And Kyrgyzstan is not a total gender relations backwater. It has all sorts of laws on the books that ensure equal rights. Kyrgyzstan even had a female president for a few years. Boys and girls are educated together. But at its heart, Kyrgyzstan's culture is traditional and conservative. There's big problems with domestic violence, child marriage, and the often brutal abduction of young women who are then forced into marriage. Those issues are getting attention now, and Asyabek says she's going to continue her activism. But the death threats have spooked her. She says now she never leaves home alone. And her family is standing by her. Kyrgyz journalist Bermat Talant says Zira's father posted a supportive message on Facebook the day after the video went viral.
And he wrote, "Do I like her look in the video? No. Does her mother like her look in the video? No. Do we want our daughter to be in her underwear on TV? No, but we respect her. We respect her right for self-expression, and we raised her to make decisions for herself. And she's a free individual in a free country."
Stay tuned for more from Zira Asyabek and the women of Kyrgyzstan. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
If you want to see the video and a translation of Zira's lyrics, we've got them at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Opioid addiction is a huge problem in this country, not just here, but in Canada, too.
I've lost so many people I care about. We weren't going to just stand by and just let people keep dying.
North America's first public injection site is in Vancouver. That's later, right here on The World. Marco Werman here with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The World's Patrick Nguyen has lived in Thailand for a decade now. He's been there long enough that grilled catfish eaten by hand is his go-to breakfast, no problem. But in his new book, Hello Shadowlands, Patrick finds himself in countless problematic situations. He visits opium dens in northern Myanmar, investigates the illicit drug trade in the Philippines, and, oh yeah, he also dances with North Korean waitresses in Thailand. I got to say, Patrick, a lot of this book feels like Fear and Loathing in Southeast Asia. I don't suspect that was the original point, but why did you undertake the survey of the region's dark underbelly in the first place?
Well, I know people are into organized crime. I mean, you look at the stuff we watch on television, Narcos, Breaking Bad, The Wire, all the way back to The Godfather. But there is this huge black spot, and that is Southeast Asia.
And do you think organized crime in Southeast Asia functions differently from what we see in movies like The Godfather or Breaking Bad?
I think the big takeaway about organized crime in Southeast Asia is it's booming and no one's talking about it. So by the middle of next decade, organized crime syndicates just in that region will control $375 billion. That's bigger than the GDP of most countries in Southeast Asia,
yeah.
Or that's bigger than the GDP of Ireland.
So just to kind of set us up and frame the rest of our conversation, I'd like you to read from the prologue to the book, starting with the line, "The West once had great political hopes for Southeast Asia."
Sure thing. "The West once had great political hopes for Southeast Asia. America in particular has long envisioned a string of just and orderly pro-U.S. democracies triumphantly prospering in China's backyard. Today, that vision looks more like a hallucination. Southeast Asia has become the domain of unelected authoritarians, or worse yet, elected leaders who behave like despots. This is the present and future of Southeast Asia, hyper-capitalistic but deeply illiberal. This autocratic sweep doesn't just benefit the entrenched political dynasties that run these nations. It's also a blessing for organized crime.
So you do kind of a big survey of many countries in Southeast Asia, but Myanmar I'd like to just focus on because it figures prominently in your book, in no small part because one of the major commodities there is meth. What is the story behind Myanmar becoming one of the world's meth capitals?
The largest meth market in the world is in Southeast Asia now. It's no longer in Mexico. The top-selling product is this little pink pill that's as pink as, say, Barbie's Corvette, okay? Yeah. And this stuff smells like vanilla cake frosting. So if there was a pill sitting here in this room, we would... Is this someone having birthday cake?
So the junkies are smoking the pills?
Yeah, and if you do, you'll get this euphoric 8-hour high, which they describe as making everything around you interesting. A lot of the work that people do in Southeast Asia is tedious, repetitive work. And if you take this pill, that drudge work becomes interesting, and so that accelerates the popularity.
Doesn't it lead to addiction, and aren't people dying?
It does lead to addiction. Of course, it's really bad for you. It's not a good idea to take it to work longer hours because it can catch up with you. But frankly, a lot of people I talk to, they aren't the junkie profile you might picture. And just like people can be functional alcoholics, you can be a functional meth user.
So it sounds like there's a cultural thing that's driving the meth use. How did the dealers and how did this economy, how was it allowed to kind of flourish?
Let's look at the place where all this stuff is coming out of. That's northern Myanmar, up on the border with China. And these pills are being produced by drug lords up there who have been allowed by the state to control little pockets of territory, almost like it's their own little kingdom. And they're very prolific. So at this point, they're churning out more than 2 billion of these pills per year.
Wow.
Okay, Starbucks doesn't sell that many cups of coffee yeah. in a year. McDonald's doesn't sell that many Big Macs in a year worldwide. The scale is massive.
Are police part of the problem? Do they allow this to happen?
Absolutely.
So if the police are part of the problem, there's another answer to the drug situation. In Myanmar, it's called the Patjasan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Who are they?
Patjasan is a Baptist vigilante group, and they're furious that there are drug lords running parts of their native territory. And so they've said, well, we can't go after drug lords because they have M16s and RPGs and all that. But we can form a vigilante group that goes out at night, snatches up anyone who's got some of those pink meth pills in their pocket, and teaches them a lesson. And so I went up there and asked, can I tag along?
Yeah, and you go on a raid with them. Would you read that part? It's on page 68.
As soon as I hop on the back of the motorbike, he twists the hand throttle, revving hard. We zip out of the compound. I can see the rest of the pack up the road, their rear lamps casting a red shimmer on the wet earth. We race ahead to rejoin the swarm. The wind is beating on my ears, damp air fluttering my collar. My feet flail about, seeking the bike's rear foot pegs. And when I find them, I dig in, stabilizing my body as we accelerate over puddles. My sneakers are soaked, and I am exhilarated. It's hard to fend off the intoxicating rush of running with a pride, charged with purpose, weapons at the ready. Most of the vigilantes are riding with two guys on one motorbike, the men in back gripping bamboo staffs. Their long weapons wobble in the wind. But my excitement is tempered by a sense of foreboding. It feels as if a dark spell has been cast, as if this mission is pregnant with violence.
It sounds like you almost start regretting that you went on this raid. Is that the case?
Well, I don't regret it now because I think it was important to document it.
Yeah.
I'm really comfortable with moral complexity in this book. And what I'm admitting is that it was fun there for a brief second. I understood the thrill of going out to mete out justice. Ultimately, no, it's not good to go out and do home invasions and snatch up drug users. But there is complexity there, and I understand why they're doing it. The police, are not doing their jobs. The state is allowing drug lords to operate in their backyards. This is what happens.
Patrick, what is the takeaway? I mean, you wrote this book ostensibly for an American audience. What do you really want them to know about what's going on in Southeast Asia?
We hear a lot of stories about the booming Asian economy. Well, that economic pie is growing and growing and growing. But there is a slice that is run by organized crime, and it's booming. I mean, now it's about $100 billion. It will be worth $375 billion soon. That is a massive jump. No one is talking about this, okay? Come on. I know Americans, you're interested in foreign organized crime, and you know that this is real. This is life or death stuff. It's happening in Southeast Asia in a very, very big way, and I think these stories need to be told.
Patrick Nguyen, one of the world's many talented contributors. His new book is Hello, Shadowlands. Patrick, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Okay, that was worrying and dramatic, but don't touch the dial because you're about to hear the B word, Brexit. Complicated, you say? Arcane? How about also dramatic and critical? And right now, the big deal with Brexit is there's no deal. So listen up. Here's the world's Chris Wolfe.
Brexit is basically a divorce.
Here are my keys. I've taken $2,000 out of our savings account because that's what I had in the bank when we first got married.
Was this some kind of joke?
And as the characters found out in the movie Kramer vs. Kramer, making the decision to leave is the easy part. The devil is in the details. Meryl Streep played the role of Brexit Britain in the movie. Today it's British Prime Minister Theresa May.
Throughout this process, I have treated the EU with nothing but respect. The UK expects the same. A good relationship at the end of this process depends on it.
Of course, leaving the EU is even more complicated than Kramer leaving Kramer.
Hey, enough, all right? What are you doing?
The 27 nations of the European Union are represented in this modern drama by Donald Tusk, President of the European Council.
The UK's proposals will need to be reworked and further negotiated. Today there's perhaps more hope, but there's surely less and less time.
Tusk is talking about Theresa May's proposed divorce settlement. His rejection of her plan earlier this week has left May in a world of hurt.
At this late stage in the negotiations, it is not acceptable to simply reject the other side's proposals without a detailed explanation and counter-proposals.
This week may prove to be a political calamity for Theresa May. Some people think it is for Britain.
Brexit is the greatest calamity to have happened in Britain in post-war history.
That's Jonathan Liss of the pro-European Union think tank British Influence.
And it was delivered on a pack of lies told to the British people, who were told that they were going to regain sovereignty, and that they were going to have increased prosperity, more jobs. Those were all lies.
That's his judgment. But there's no doubt those hopes were real for many people, the so-called Brexiteers, that once mighty England could regain its national sovereignty and carve out its own place in the world again, and control immigration. The basic issue is deceptively simple.
Brexit is British exit, leaving the EU, where Britain has been a member for over 45 years.
Michelle Egan is a fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington.
And they will leave an international organization, leave 27 other European states behind, and on the 29th of March 2019, they'll cease to be a party to this big, large economic market with laws, regulations, and free movement of travel across all of the continent.
The EU is not a single country like the US, but it's pretty close. Britain's a big part of the EU in terms of population. It's equivalent to, say, California. Now, this is not constitutionally possible, but just imagine, for argument's sake, what it would be like if California tried to get divorced from the US. Michelle Egan again.
In terms of the integration of their economy, their trade, they'll have to have new customs duties, new borders, new checks.
Then you have to divide up assets and liabilities. But unlike a divorce, there is no precedent for this.
To what extent will Britain follow the same rules, same standards, and have the same market access? And the Europeans are saying, you're leaving, you're a third country, you're going to be like Canada, the United States, or others, so you can have a trade deal down the road. But right now, we need you to leave.
Joanne, please.
And I don't love you anymore.
Brexiteers hope they can regain their country's national pride, make Britain great again. But economists agree Brexit will be a drag on the UK's prosperity. For the World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
People living in Northern Ireland are especially concerned about the future. After Brexit, this will be the only part of Britain that shares a land border with the EU. Michael Gallagher is a senior economist for the Derry City and Strabane District Council. The city is located in Northern Ireland, just a few miles from the border with the Republic of Ireland. And Michael joins me on the line now from his home there. Laid out for us, Michael, the Republic of Ireland to the south of Northern Ireland is EU, but Northern Ireland will follow the British vote to leave the EU. Did I sum that up correctly?
That's correct. So even though the council, which I represent, voted to remain overwhelmingly by about 80%, the whole of the UK is now poised to leave the EU. For a city such as this, and let's talk about the geography, I suppose, for a minute to put people in the picture. We're in an enclave almost to the north, to the south and to the west of Derry. We're only around 4 miles away from what will be the international frontier with the EU. So it's about 10 minutes drive from the centre of Derry.
So how are you trying to prepare Derry for Brexit? Like, what scenarios worry you the most?
We began as soon as the vote took place, unexpectedly. We then looked for clarity as we went through the process. What would it mean? What could it possibly mean? A hard Brexit, which is one with trades and tariffs and complications on the border, or a soft Brexit, which I suppose at its extreme, we would notice very little difference. And the worry is that we'll return, I suppose, to a difficult border where people will be held up, and it'll cause immense difficulty in day-to-day life.
Presumably there's going to be kind of bureaucracy along this border. Will there be families that will be actually kind of disconnected because they don't want to deal with the paperwork and getting across the border?
We hope there won't be paperwork. The guarantees that we've been given from the British government and the Irish government and the EU are that there won't be difficulties for individuals. The worry is more, I suppose, about businesses and how they will operate. If it's a hard Brexit, then there could be immense difficulties in getting particularly food across the border. A lot of the food that we consume in Northern Ireland comes from the Republic of Ireland and vice versa. We export a lot of food. So any delays in that would obviously result in the food spoiling and loss of revenue and potential loss of jobs. But any delay at the frontier in itself will cause a dislocation and uncompetitiveness, which as an economist, I would say will be detrimental to the quality of life of people living here.
So what is the mood about Brexit where you are in Derry? What are people saying?
A mixture in the past of we don't really think it's going to happen. Then that move towards, well, what might it mean? Increasingly, as time has gone on and there's less clarity about what it actually means in practice, I suppose for some businesses, they're on the verge of panic as to how do they prepare for something that they don't know the extent or degree to which it'll complicate their business life. If you know that things are going to get bad, then you can plan for it. But if you just don't know how bad, or whether they're bad at talking, then it's very, very hard to decide what to do. So we've been told by businesses that investment decisions on both sides of the border have been delayed and put on hold. So there's some clarity as to what this will look like in the future.
You know, I saw this spoof video where a so-called soft border patrol officer talks about identifying cows from Northern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland by how they moo.
And when the cow said moo, if the cow went moo, it's from the Republic. If the cow goes moo, moo, Northern Irish cow.
Do people in Derry have a sense of humour about Brexit?
I think there's still a belief that it'll not actually happen. I think given everything we've come through in terms of the Troubles, the 50th anniversary of essentially the outbreak of the Troubles in 1968, which happened in Derry, will happen on October 5th. You know, given everything we've been through, we think we can deal with it. As ever, there'll be Irish solutions to an Irish problem, I suppose, as quite often is the case.
Michael Gallagher is a senior economist for the Derry and Strabane District Council. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you, Ned.
More than 115. That's how many people are dying from opioid overdoses in the U.S. every day. A lot of that has to do with potent drugs like fentanyl getting into the heroin supply. It's a health crisis across North America, and Vancouver in Canada has already been on the front lines of that crisis for years. In 2003, it established the first supervised drug injection site in North America. These are places where IV drug users can inject opioids under medical supervision. These sites are illegal in the U.S., but in Vancouver, they're now experimenting with more informal kinds of supervised sites, including ones run by drug users. Ilana Gordon has a story from Vancouver.
During an overdose, a drug like heroin floods the brain's control center, the part that reminds us to breathe, turning a powerful shot into a potentially fatal one.
I don't even remember finishing the shot. I just remember bringing it up and
you know, starting to do it, and it was going in, and then, and that was it.
Matt Savage overdosed about 4 years ago. That could have been the end, but he was at InSight, Vancouver's supervised injection facility.
Like the nurse actually watched me just go right out and said, yeah, you didn't even get done. Then I looked up, and they still had my, my rig was sitting on the desk, and it was still half full.
The nurse, Savage learned, had given him naloxone and saved his life. The medication blocks heroin's deadly grip and can reverse an overdose on the spot. InSight's very existence came out of years of drug users and activists fighting for such a space. But this one supervised injection site has been no match for fentanyl. The narcotic is up to 50 times more potent than heroin. It hit the illegal drug market around 2016, and within a year, overdose deaths in Vancouver went up 80%.
See you in the morning, 10 o'clock, knock really loud.
Around the corner from InSight, Tina Shaw walks through the streets and alleys, constantly checking on people.
Hey, you okay, honey?
Yeah.
Oh, I just want to make sure you weren't overdosing. Sorry, wake you up.
Shaw is a petite redhead with a big presence who for years had a cocaine addiction. When people started dying in record numbers, she knew she had to do something.
Paramedics were so overworked, it would take between 12 and 25 minutes for them to show up to an overdose call. 12 and 25 minutes is too long. They're gone.
Shaw and other activists decided to set up their own kind of injection sites. At first, they put up medic tents in the alleys, right where people were overdosing. They stood watch with naloxone and breathing masks at the ready.
I've lost so many people I care about because of fentanyl. We weren't going to just stand by and just let people keep dying.
Their tents were illegal, but when public health officials visited, they declared a public health emergency and funded them. Now there are more than 40 of these more informal sites across British Columbia. They're in apartment buildings, homeless shelters, and even in some rural communities. Shaw leads me to the one she helped start. It's called the Molson Overdose Prevention Site. It's in a former bank.
We're open from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 11 o'clock at night.
The entrance is in an alley just a few blocks from InSight, Vancouver's first supervised injection site. But there's a big difference. Nurses don't run this place. Peers, like Daniel Beaverstock, do.
We're also in active use, most of us. And there's something there that exists between, you know, that's why we're peers, right?
Beaverstock sits at a table by the door, helping people sign in.
Jules, I got a table for you. Go ahead. What are you using? Okay.
Social workers are on hand, but lots of the staff are active drug users, like Beaverstock, who are also trained to respond to overdoses. So when Beaverstock's not on the clock being paid to work, he injects his own drugs here, too.
Both to save my life, and how can I encourage other people to come and use here if I'm out in the streets using myself?
He credits these sites for saving his life dozens of times.
And I said, if there's any ever a way I can give back, just ask and I'll do it.
When a booth opens up, Beaverstock directs people to the main area.
All right, so go ahead, table four.
Picture a room with clean needles and other injection supplies in the middle, and then eight rectangular metal tables set up along the walls. Stephanie Peterson is sitting at table three. She uncaps a new needle.
I need to get my hit, so I hope you don't mind.
She lights a match to cook her drugs in a small metal cup, then draws the drugs up. Peterson says she's been addicted to heroin since she was a teenager.
I'm in tears every day because of dope. I still use it, yeah, but it's not like it's really easy to put the dope down. If it was easy, I would have put it down a long time ago, but it's not, which sucks.
Then fentanyl upped the stakes.
I don't think people, like, realize how dangerous this whole fentanyl thing is. In the last, like, 12 months, I've lost at least 11 or 12 close friends.
Since these informal sites started popping up 2 years ago, they've reported more than 130,000 visits and have reversed more than 1,000 overdoses. The local police are on board, and the regional coroner estimates without supervised injection, fatal overdoses might be 3 times as high. The approach is gaining support in other parts of the country, with more sites opening. But it does have its critics.
What we're doing now is trying to put a Band-Aid on the symptoms of what's happening without ever really getting to a more meaningful long-term outcome.
Tom Stamatakis is president of the Canadian Police Association. He says with such a tainted drug supply, The focus should be on getting people into treatment programs, but currently they can have waiting lists. And on the other side of the country, Ontario's new Conservative Prime Minister also wants more investment in treatment and has placed a moratorium on new injection sites in his province.
The fact is no one has died at a safe consumption site. Nobody has died.
That's Mary Claire Zack, one of Vancouver's policy directors. She says supervised injection is part of a smart public health strategy to deal with the drug crisis. She doesn't want people doing drugs in secret and dying.
One of the biggest problems, though, that we're still faced with is that people who use drugs, they die when they use alone. And they're not feeling like they can tell anybody, a neighbor, a friend, their family, to watch out for them.
Back at the Molson site in downtown Vancouver, Stephanie Peterson searches for a spot on her elbow to inject her drugs. It takes her a few minutes. She says here in this place, with peers so involved, she doesn't fear being judged.
For me personally, it's life-changing because it's almost like home. As weird as it sounds, like, I feel comfortable here. I know all the staff. I get along with people. I know that nothing's going to happen to me in here. It's my safe house, basically. It's my safe zone.
Recently, a big business association in Vancouver asked for a site to be opened in their upscale district to prevent overdoses in store bathrooms. The city plans to open at least two more sites by the end of the year. And in Ontario, where the Prime Minister has put a temporary ban on new injection sites, a group just set up their own in a city park. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
An innovative solution from our neighbors to the north. And that'll do it for us today. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.